Welcome to How We Got There. I am your host, Mike Davis, founder of Go-To-Market Guides. I interview thought leaders and founders in the Salesforce ecosystem to help ISVs learn new things to try and mistakes to avoid. This episode of How We Got There is brought to you by ISV App. ISV App is used by leading Salesforce ISVs and OEMs as the central toolbox to reduce churn, increase renewals, identify upsell potential, and close more deals. ISV App is the only plug-and-play solution for the AppExchange App Analytics API and provides deep product insights. The setup is easy and takes less than 5 minutes. Visit isvapp.com, that's isvapp.com, to learn how you can take advantage of usage data in your app today. All right, I am here with Chris Federspiel, who is the founder and CEO of Blackthorn. Chris, thanks for coming on.
Yeah, thanks so much. I'm flattered that you wanted me to come on here, Mike.
Yeah, no, I was listening to another podcast and I was like, Chris is a guy who this community needs to hear from. So I guess to kick things off, tell me a little bit about how you found your way into the Salesforce ecosystem and then blend that into what Blackthorn does.
For sure. So in high school, I was writing some Perl and CGI scripts for Chad Meyer, who's the founder of Internet Creations. People in support departments know their company for the Email to Case Premium app. And in early 2011, I gave him a ring and said, hey, can you bring me on to do anything with an IT job? He's like, have you heard of this thing, Salesforce? I'm like, I don't know what that is, but sure, I can learn it. And then in 2011, when I started in January, I got 4 certifications rather quickly. I started doing sales with him, but I was also selling org migrations and then doing them myself, as well as getting relationships with Salesforce, setting up support department stuff, learning everything there is to do as an admin. At least at that time, the platform was a lot smaller. And that was the beginning and it got me hooked.
Nice. And yeah, tell us a little bit about what Blackthorn does and how you help your customers.
Yeah, we started by making a payments app where you could do a charge or a refund right out of Salesforce. It's, you know, pretty common kind of use case, but it branched into a lot of different types of payments with the intent of creating that to have a few different layers on top of the payments app. So we then released an event management app. You can think of it as using Eventbrite or Cvent from within Salesforce, as well as then acquiring the Texty application, as well as the PCIFI application. So we now do SMS as well as different compliance related work. And we're working on a commerce app that will be out in a few months. So in terms of what we do, Salesforce does a lot out of the box. We fill in a lot of very common gaps that higher ed and nonprofits have, but the apps are used by pretty much any type of business.
So that's interesting, the higher ed and nonprofit focus. So I don't know if they go by .org anymore, or at least legacy.org. Maybe you could share a little bit about kind of commonalities with the Salesforce.com side of the world versus the nonprofit and education.org side of the world.
Yeah, for sure. So there's a lot of different paths to take this conversation. The .org side for the longest time was very tightly knit. The higher ed side and then the nonprofit side started to separate a bit once the unique data models came out, and there's been some interesting internal politics that were at play there, such as their Elevate app not working with higher ed and some interesting conversations there. But the route that we ended up going down for our applications within those realms was because organically, the inquiries that came in went into buckets. We had a lot of nonprofit interest and a lot of higher ed interest. And in being a non-VC funded company, we had to pick a lane. So if we went after for-profit companies, we had to focus our events app on doing things with sponsorships and calls for proposals and all different types of use cases. But going after higher ed and nonprofits, they have nearly the same use cases. Higher ed doesn't do stuff like auctions, but neither of them really focus so much on sponsorships or other nuanced event-based functionalities. So we were able to work with one entity at Salesforce, which was salesforce.org. And then we were able to focus our roadmap down one mostly clear path. So it ended up making sense. And the nonprofit deals are aplenty. The higher ed deals tend to have a higher ACV. So we ended up working both of those angles, and that's been the go-to-market focus. But the apps themselves are data model agnostic. So roughly half of our revenue comes outside of those verticals. The other half is inside of those verticals.
Nice. Thank you for sharing that. And I guess as you've been building this company, what are you most proud of?
My definition for a startup for the longest time was a company that couldn't pay the bills or barely could without getting some money from somewhere. And once we were able to pay the bills, then I felt the business was successful. But you know, at this point, we have 553 customers and the apps do a lot. I can't say that I absolutely love them yet. I'm very particular in my love of what our applications do. Our team's done a phenomenal job, but forever we've never had a product team. I was just the product person, and I am horrible at user experience, even though our apps are able to get live within an hour without having a SI partner have to do anything. A non-admin can come in and just click some buttons, and you can be processing payments within 15 minutes of installation or have a live event up and running within 20 to 25 minutes, right? The apps are really easy to use. But I envision this world where you've never used Salesforce ever, and someone allows you to log in and you can get all the way from start to finish to having a live event or process a payment without ever looking at the documentation and having no knowledge of Salesforce. That's the bar that I'm having us strive for. And at that point, then it's a different degree of the love of a product. There's very few companies I think that exist where people truly love their products. If you buy something from Apple, the experience of opening the box and the simplicity of using the app, like that's how I want our apps to feel. And there's very few, if any, Salesforce apps, both internal and AppExchange ones, that you can install and be live almost immediately and just like feel like it's terrific. It's very hard to capture that. That's what I'm having us strive for.
I love that. That's a big goal because you're right. I mean, the Salesforce does have to be configured and all of the apps tend to as well. So that'll be fun to watch you achieve that.
Yeah, the .org team actually made something amazing with their use of install.salesforce.org. The way that they created the menu that functions with MetaDeploy and Cumulus CI, how you can just go there and you just click buttons and it drops in modules. We're going to be deploying that very soon. It's going to be candyshop.blackthorn.io, where you're going to be able to click any of the apps, and it allows the apps to script through package dependencies and to automatically deploy fields, configure relationships, do certain things with permission sets. It gets us a lot further towards that experience of not having to know anything about Salesforce in order to get live. And kudos to them for setting that up. It was a great inspiration to us, but that's part of the foundation. And sorry to cut you off there. I just get very excited talking about this thing. It's been needed in the ecosystem for years, and finally it exists.
No, I appreciate it. And you showed your bias towards product, and I'll show you my bias towards customer experience and buyer's journey. I wonder if that technology that you were just talking about could help even further trial force environments for sales engineer, or even AE demos. If you could like off the shelf in the same trial force source org, and then have like different verticals, different use cases with that candy shop idea. I don't know. Have you thought about that at all? Or am I barking up the wrong tree?
We've actually worked with a lot of SEs to figure out ways that we can make the app rapidly demoable, because SEs they'll get told an hour before a demo, a day before a demo, we need you to do XYZ. They don't have time to fiddle with the stuff. They just need to click a button and have it go live. Where it gets tricky is when you need to deploy components from a managed package onto a specific non-managed community page that they're doing a demo out of. It's very hard in order to get to a non configured demo from scratch without doing some stuff. So it's getting down that path. The very nature of Salesforce, there's only certain things that you can fully automate. The rest still has some config, but it really is getting closer to that.
Nice. Yeah, no, I dig that. And I mean, a lot of founders and go-to-market leaders listen to this podcast. Well, not a lot, but we're a small niche community.
Yep.
As you've been building the business, any mistakes to share to help people avoid them?
Yeah, so I appreciate sending over the questions so I could think about them ahead of time. And this is the only one that I stared at, and I had no idea what I was going to say on here. And it occurred to me that my answer is to see a therapist early on. It's not a particular business issue, but the very nature of starting any company brings in so many unknowns. Like I never could have imagined how many questions had to get answered. And then to manage, to run a company that's primarily bootstrapped, we only raised 150K for the longest time to really get this thing off the ground. To manage cash flow with that is psychologically really hard, particularly if you don't have a co-founder. And I started with two co-founders and now it's just me here. But even after there was the separation of us, it's really hard. And having an outlet to help with talking about emotion and keeping myself stable, or really anyone, has been the best thing I've done in order to help the business.
Ah, thank you for sharing that. And I mean, yeah, you go in on your own, even if you had co-founders, I still think the advice is valid to help that relationship stay strong. And you mentioned it there. I mean, next to no VC, I mean, no VC in modern terms by any means, but the dollar amounts being raised. How'd you weigh out the pros and cons? I mean, I guess talk to us a little bit about your approach there.
Sure. So I have a moderate to larger ego, I guess, where I never really liked having a boss. So the concept of raising money and having to report to someone just was never really so appealing to me. But Salesforce allows you to sort of cheat the system a bit, because most companies that start their apps don't have this concept of being able to do services. Because the SI ecosystem is so big and people pretty much expect something to get configured, what we did early on was that we would sell a project, but maintain the IP, and all the projects that we took were in the same general scope. So each project we incrementally built onto the code base. So we were also fortunate to get a few bigger deals, and it's always a relative term, but earlier on the deals would be 80K, 200K, 50K. It helps to have something sizable that a very small team can work on for a longer period of time, because there's a lot less logistic that has to go into staffing the project and overlapping projects and so forth. So by doing the services projects, it allowed us to effectively fund the work that then went into it.
Nice. And I mean, are you still thinking even in the future? Because you guys are growing like crazy, I know. Are you considering VC, debt? What's that look like?
Yeah, I'll just tell you how we've been able to do stuff. So at the end of 2018, maybe in July, I was pretty sure we were going to go bank. In August, we had 7K in the bank account. And then I got into the launch accelerator it's the Jason Calacanis accelerator in San Francisco. So I ended up flying back and forth and stayed out there a while for 12 weeks. And that was 100 of the 150K. I pitched 100 investors. It was set, give or take, 7 investors a week for 12 weeks. And every single one of them said no. I'm like, okay, so I'm clearly not very good at raising, or no one cares about what we're trying to do, or I'm not clear. I don't know what it is. So then we got really capital efficient. We did a whole bunch of interesting things with the business to make the money extend and bring any money in. And then launching events in early 2019, it then started to take off. So eventually then we got up to a few million ARR, and I thought, why don't we try to make this thing go faster? And we evaluated a few different sources and then got to Capchase, where, if you're familiar with Pipe.com, with Capchase, you sell your contract, they fund it on day one, and you pay them back. So for example, If you have a contract for 10K, they'll give you 9K today, and then over the next 12 months, you pay them back 10K. They'll make the difference. I'm oversimplifying the math, but it's something like that. And we have a deal with them where they're funding a bit over 50% of our ARR as debt. You can think of it as a line of credit. It's not the same mechanism because they're buying the single year of the contract. But it allowed us to triple our team size and put a lot into sales and marketing during last year without having to dilute at all. So we went from around April until maybe October. We went from 25-ish people, and now we have a bit over 80 people. And we haven't had to dilute the cap table to be able to do that. And we've just taken on some debt. And in that time, we went over 100% growth. So now we're at 8.3 ARR, and we're targeting another 100% growth again this year. And if we do go to have a raise, it wouldn't be for doing like a big 30, 40 million Series B. It would just be to pay off the debt and then have that open line available there. And at this point, our debt is a little, what is it? I guess a bit over 3 million. But some of the debt is variable if it's from CapChase, or we have like a private loan, which has helped us extend it a lot. Because if you can get a 24-month loan, you can pay the loan with your own revenue rather than CapChase and Pipe and FounderPath and ClearBank and all these models that have a 12-month cycle. You end up having to borrow in order to pay. So it's a question of if you want to give up cap table dilution or if you want to incur fees. So I've been okay with incurring fees because if you look at all the exits in our market, they're all substantial. And if we can get there without having dilution or even significant dilution, you know, if we give up a point or two to be able to pay off some debt, it's very different from giving up 20, 25% in a round, which at an exit could be 50, 100 million plus. So that's been the mentality and the theory or thesis I've taken forward with the company so far. And everyone in the, I tell these same numbers openly because I tell our employees, our team, every month, because everybody has stock options and some people have a pretty good amount. And if we're able to do this without diluting and get a pretty good exit, I think we calculated from the exit we're looking for and what people are, it's going to make something like 18 to 20 millionaires in the company, which is pretty amazing if we can actually get to the growth numbers we're looking for.
That's amazing. I love that. And I appreciate you sharing so openly. There's many different ways to get there. And I don't want to disparage people that go the VC route by any means, but those VC rounds are very loud and they tend to be press releases. And I just wish folks like you put out some press releases. Hey, we're still bootstrapping this thing. We're still just on debt. I think that'd be a fun thing to put out there.
Yeah, it's very unsexy to say, oh, you know, we have 5-6 million of debt available from these facilities. Like, no one cares. TechCrunch is not going to run some big article on that. Like, everyone wants to see a 40 million Series B. It's like a big sign to the market saying, hey, like, this company is amazing. But I have friends at these companies with big valuations. They have 5%, 10% left of the company. And it's hard because we're all out doing the same amount of work. And from the outside, the company looks amazing. But at the end of the day, when you go to exit, it's a different outcome. So it's, I don't know, the concept of raising, everyone keeps telling me to raise, but I just don't understand why. Like, if we're able to pay off some debt and get to an exit with a big chunk of the cap table, it seems more interesting. And if money isn't the main motivator and we get to continue to have control over what it is that we're doing, then we're not under what anyone tells us that we have to do. So I don't know. I have strong opinions here, but
I appreciate it. And you mentioned how you give all your employees stock options. That's great. And especially in a non-dilutive growth pattern that you're on, that's even more useful. But you also provide a four-day work week, which is something that I'm personally passionate about because Blake Lee and Eric, when I was at TaskRay, allowed me to go 4 days a week to start my business. And so
nice.
I guess I'm curious on how you went about it, why, what you've seen, any sort of pitfalls to avoid.
Well, I love riding my bicycle, and I was annoyed that I could only do it on the weekend because you can't do like two really long bike rides on Saturday and Sunday. It's like impossible to be in a relationship with anyone if you do that, but also the body gets too tired. So I wanted to ride on Saturday. On Friday. So I started to take some more Fridays off, and I thought everybody probably wants to do that. So we were doing every other Friday off for the last 6 months. And then Stuart's like, the UK, he's our CRO. The UK is pushing to do this across the country, why don't we just do it? I'm like, okay, fine, let's do it. And it wasn't really much of a conversation. It was more natural at that point. And that was 2 weeks ago. We haven't officially had a press release. I think our team is trying to press release something. So this is the first you're going to hear about it, but that's what we have going on, and everybody loves it. The only nuance is that some of the teams, they have alternating schedules. So they'll be off Thursday, Friday of 1 week, and then they'll work through the next week. Like if you're in support or if you're in some kind of engineering capacity where you need to do something.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. I mean, customer service, just because you're taking 4 days doesn't mean your customers are.
Exactly.
So I think that's fair. Any kind of cautions to share, unintended consequences yet, or too soon to tell?
No, I mean, we did the every other Friday for so long and nothing arose at all. So I think this is pretty much just more of the same thing, and it's been fine. And we told everyone we'll keep doing this so long as we keep hitting our goals and there's no issues. So it's really on the team to figure out a lot of the dynamics. We set the general guidelines, and then each department has their own dynamics.
Love it. Yeah. Everybody's an adult. Be an adult.
Yep.
And then just to keep going on, I mean, you guys are growing well. Good work-life balance. And then you're donating money, as I understand it, as well. I guess, who are you donating to and why?
Yeah, this is me paraphrasing Benioff or Bill Gates. And as a business, you have a, like, not a mandate, but like there's some impetus there to do something with the money. Like it only really does or matters so much to have so much money. Like it really is on the person running the company to say, hey, like we have this money, let's do something. Now, granted, a lot of the money that we give away is actually part of us borrowing the money. So it's a little bit of a weird philosophy. But I remember Benioff said that he was giving away he was doing his 111 pledge 1% plan even before the company was really making money. And we do 1% of revenue to strike climate. It's not 1% of profit. I think when companies say they give away some amount of profit, unless you're public and you're forced to be profitable, like your profit's honestly pretty low for a private company, if anything. Like like we didn't pay tax last year or the prior because we had such big losses. Like there's no profit at all. And the same thing is going to happen this year. Like if you have a year where you're borrowing or you're raising VC, you don't have profit. Your expenses greatly exceed your revenue. But I wanted us to be able to donate without saying something tied to profit. So we give away 1% of revenue to Strike Climate, as well as giving $1,000 a month to WOTC.org. They help fund surgeries in different, how do I say, areas where it's hard to get medical support, I guess, or the surgery is quite expensive, as well as to a organization in Tanzania to help some kids in school. Like it's a very direct impact type of scenario. So I think it's important to do any kind of giving back. I don't know, maybe I have some kind of guilt based from nothing or something. I don't know. But I also set up a 501c3 where when we get closer to an exit, which is minimum a few years out, I'll be moving a certain amount of my shares into the 501c3, and that will just give away money from there, because I've just found the New York Times wrote some article, and there's some study that was done in the country. It used to be 75K, now it's 100K. Once a family gets over 100K, there's no incremental degree of happiness. I feel a little differently if you're in Manhattan. It's probably like 125K or something. But pretty much in the US, over 100K, there isn't an incremental amount of happiness. And anything beyond that is just wanting to, for the sake of wanting more. So you might as well do something with the money. So I don't know. That's why we give money away. I don't know if that's a direct or indirect answer.
No, it's good. I mean, yeah, you're doing good while you're being successful. It's the best of all worlds. And you chimed in the Slack community about this conversation and just being a former services business leader. I would love to get your thoughts and opinions around how ISVs should approach SIs in the ecosystem.
So SIs are our biggest source of, well, they traditionally were our biggest source of revenue. We're doing a lot more direct-to-customer work now because you can't scale a business like by predominantly majority from referral. Like going direct is the way to scale it under control and faster. But for the longest time from partners, it was the biggest source of revenue. And it works by partners looking at the AppExchange for a solution or hearing by word of mouth. And we always did everything conceivable for partners. So if a partner was implementing or scoping or had an RFP or some technical architecture question, emails, calls, anything, we'd schedule a meeting. We would just, anything possible we could do for the partner, we would do it. Because the partner then, if someone says, I want to do payments, I want to do events, I want to do SMS for my customer, the partner is not going to build it. Like it costs millions of dollars in payroll to make these things. They need to plug something in and run with it. So they're going to reach out to find something. It might as well be you. So the way that we've worked with partners is to do everything possible we can with them. And we set up shared Slack environments. We have periodic check-ins to go over roadmaps and basically anything we can.
Man, that's very similar to how Conga found their success in the SI world. Just putting technical resources at the ready and jumping in as they needed it. And so you just establish that trust with them.
Yep, exactly.
Nice. And you mentioned this earlier, just around your advice and biggest mistake around not getting therapy sooner. You shared with me leading up to this, just being a bipolar founder. I guess for other folks who might be in the same position, what advice or what experience, how has it shaped you?
Certainly doesn't make it easier. I have bipolar too, so I've never found myself ending up in the hospital, which a lot of bipolar people do find themselves up in. So it's a little bit more mild, but everybody experiences it differently. So for me, I tend to make a lot of decisions quicker than I should. There isn't so much of a analysis of consequence with bipolar. There's also a lot of mornings or half days where I'm cranky or short with people. And then other days I'm super happy and making jokes, and it makes it hard. There's been some days where I've had to tell the team, hey, I'm staying offline all day and I'll be doing emails, but I'm not joining any calls. Or I will take off some period of time just to sit around the house and watch movies because there's no way I can bring myself to do any amount of work without being disruptive or pushing someone's buttons or something. And it makes it hard. So I've been very clear with our team, like, look, this is what I have. This is what happens. I know it will be hard to not take it personally, but I'm letting you know what it is. I'm always quick to realize that I've done something wrong by apologizing and acknowledging the team that something has happened. And it's not good. If anybody listening to this has any kind of mental illness, make sure you're seeing a therapist and make sure you also see a psychiatrist, because I've been on medication for 20 years. If I haven't, there's no way I could be running this company. It does have its gifts, though. I think there's something about bipolar that makes someone more erring towards creativity, where a lot of the ideas for the company, I guess for better or worse, with product decisions, I've concocted out of thin air or on these long bike rides. And it also has allowed me to take on a lot of initiatives at once, which early on is not good for focus. But now that we have multiple product teams and a 50 plus person engineering team, we can work on more things at once. So it's a blessing and a curse. Almost everybody I know that I've met that has something like this never talks about it. So I might seem like an anomaly talking about it on here, but there's a lot more people that have this than are public.
Totally, totally. And I appreciate you sharing. Yeah, you never know who's listening and who can get inspired by it. So thank you.
For sure.
So awesome. Chris, we're going to wrap up with the final three rapid fire question, 10 second answers. You ready to go?
Yeah, let's do it.
Who is one company or person in the ecosystem that you track or follow?
So I read this question and I thought, I don't follow anyone in the ecosystem. I follow everything Elon Musk does, Paul Graham, and a lot of the outside of the ecosystem, like massive success people.
Love it. That's fair enough. What would you tell yourself day one of working in the ecosystem?
Ugh, learn Salesforce. Don't try to do anything until you get your admin certification. And don't do it by studying other people's study guides. It's ridiculous. Try to actually do the functions yourself in Salesforce on your own.
Love it. Lastly, what gives you energy in your personal life?
The license to be creative. We're at a point now where we have the luxury to make cool new stuff and not have to rush it. And I find that fun.
Nice. Well, Chris, absolute pleasure having you on. I could have talked to you for another hour. thanks so much for sharing.
Yeah, Mike, thanks so much for having me on.
Thank you for listening, and I hope you learned something from today's episode of How We Got There. If you enjoyed this episode, make sure to subscribe on iTunes and leave a review. I'll see you here next time.